Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Doomer Optimism podcast. I am here with Phelim Hardy. This episode is one that has been a long time coming. I have been interested in sort of more ecological approaches to water treatment, sanitation, gray water, black water, all these kinds of things. On my property, we have a gray water treatment facility and just a garden. And a compost toilet. I visited this ecological municipal water treatment plant outside of Portland, Oregon. It must have been 10 years ago now. And it's kind of stuck in my head as this really interesting approach to what we typically approach in a kind of industrial manner, which is, you know, cleaning water, cleaning waste. And so Phelim has a really interesting approach to this and experience with this. So we're going to talk, you know, sort of ecological approaches to water today, water treatment and ways to think about that. Welcome Phelim. I'll have you introduce yourself to start, and then we can kind of let the conversation go from there.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Great to be here. Okay. So introductions. I'm Phelim Hardy. I've been designing reed bed systems, or I started out in my career designing reed bed systems and constructed wetlands in the mid-1990s. And I've been doing that pretty much up until COVID. And then, like many people, had a change in tech, and I've shifted gear slightly, and I'm very much enjoying that. So it's still working with water, still working with waterways and improving water quality, but it's just taking a slightly different approach to working with sewage treatment.
Okay.
But I'm happy to discuss all of it, because sewage treatment teaching and seminars and workshops, they're all part of what I offer at the moment anyway.
Okay, great. So let's start with the doom, as we tend to do. So what are some of the critiques about the ways in which we approach sewage treatment typically in municipalities and you know, I know it's different in rural and urban areas. In urban areas, there tend to be like whole sewage systems. In rural areas, a lot of times there's different approaches to, the septic systems. Lay out the doom about, you know, the ways at which we're thinking about sewage treatment typically.
True. So perhaps what might be, perhaps maybe a good place to start is to jump in and say how I got into this in the first place, which kind of answers your question in a way, and it paints a very, very typical scenario. So I grew up on the shores of Cork Harbour in the south of Ireland, and so I grew up right beside the harbour. So when I could hear the waves through the bedroom window, and when the tide was in, it was literally a stone's throw across the road. When the tide was out, it was a bit further away, you know. Wow. But it was lovely, really, really nice. Now, the challenge is that Cork Harbour wasn't very, very clean at the time. You know, it was one of the more industrialised parts of Ireland, which isn't very industrialised.
Right.
But at the same time, for Ireland, it was quite industrialised. And thus, a lot of gunk had got into the harbour over the years. And I used to windsurf there and quite enjoyed that. But then our local town, Middleton, had they were struggling with their sewage load into the harbour, basically, which was a short pipe, which went from Middleton into Cork Harbour. Mm. Like many, many other towns all around the harbour and all around Ireland and all around anywhere where you've got a flush toilet. You know, mm-hmm. It's not necessarily everywhere or the norm, but it's not uncommon mm-hmm. for raw sewage or sewage that's been what's called primary settlement. So it's been through a box and then straight into the sea. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't see any nasty bits, but at the same time, you know, it's all the nutrients, nitrates, phosphates, the microbes, all that stuff all goes in. So there was, around the early 1990s, there was a discussion locally as to what Middleton would do with its sewage. And so the solution that the county council, the local authority, came up with at the time was a very common solution adopted by a lot of places, which was a longer pipe. And longer pipe came out closer to where I used to go windsurfing. And so there was one day when I was standing on my board, it was really, really flat calm. My uncle had said, look, stand up on your board, throw your kit bag on the back, and you just drift across, you know, from where we were to to your house. And so I did that. So I had all the gear on the back of the board, and I was standing there, and the wind dropped. It was a still day, but the wind dropped even lower, and the sea went kind of glassy, which, if you're any good at windsurfing, it's very, very boring. But if you're not very good at windsurfing, it should be fine. But anyway, I could, as the surfboard slowed down, I could see this scum rippling up in front of the board. And I knew that it was directly related to the sewage inputs from around Cork Harbour and to the longer pipe that had recently gone in. And so that kind of got me thinking about the whole thing. And at the time, a local residency group that my mother was very much involved in teamed together with an engineer called Ciarán Costello. And he had been working with constructed wetlands and knew people around the world who were into this. And because it was still a very new technology at the time in Ireland. And their local group got together and they organized the first Irish international conference, the first international conference in Ireland on constructed wetland systems. And so
And
they
what
pulled,
year was that about?
that was 1993. That was 93. Yeah. So Don Hammer came over from the Tennessee Valley Authority. Professor Harbel came over from Austria. There were experts in from the UK, from Northern Ireland, and around the Republic of Ireland. And there weren't a lot of people involved in this at the time, but Ciarán and the group that my mother was in, they pulled together people from right around the world. And so I was in second year in college at this stage, studying environmental science and technology already. And so I kind of sat back and took the lazy option and said, oh, I don't need to learn all that stuff about sewage treatment systems and concrete and steel and loading rates. You just build a big wetland and you're fine. So what I did was put together now, did you know, it's disconcerting because your frame freezes from time to time. You can
Oh,
see
that's
me
okay.
fine.
Yeah, no, yeah, and I can
Oh,
see you
cool.
fine. And
Lovely.
if it
That's
does
great.
that, that's fine. Yeah.
Brilliant. So I was electrified by this and found it really, really interesting. And so I have a business model for any young graduates that are watching this. I graduated in June of 1996 with my degree in environmental science and technology, and I set up as a consultant in July, which I think is a great business model for anybody. I did go to sign on for welfare in December because I hadn't worked at all, and then got a job photocopying in an environmental office a week later. And then gradually pulled back from that job after 2 years and in the local university where I was working in a local environmental office, working with industry. So that's kind of where you start with sewage treatment. One of the problems with sewage treatment is the pipe. That's the issue because generally a pipe is designed to get something further away from you. And the faster you want to get something away from you, the more likely it is that it's a problem to wherever it's going. So all around the world, where you've got conventional flush toilets, where that's your standard technology, there's that basically you're going to have pollution problems. Do you know it in a word?
Yeah, what will you talk about, and then I want to hear a little bit about the history too, but can you talk a little bit about helping people to understand like ecologically what is going on with these nutrients? And
Okay.
one way I could think about it is, for example, if you see a CAFO, concentrated animal farm operation, if you've ever driven by one, they smell so horrendously, and you just tend to think like, wow, animal agriculture is just so horrible. Look at how much pollution there is. But it's really a matter of the concentration of the manure in the urine that makes that smell. In contrast, around where I live in a rural area where there's farmland, if the animals are on an appropriate amount of land, it doesn't smell because there's a ecological system that kind of integrates those nutrients into the system. And so it's really like a concentration problem. And I think a lot of people talk about the solution to pollution is dilution. That's not true for every like environmental issue or pollution issue, but yeah, let's talk a little bit about what's
Okay.
going on. It's just like it's a concentration issue, right?
No.
Oh, it's not.
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I think that there's a number of different things that you've looked at in there. Let's begin to tease them apart. So firstly, when I'm talking about sewage, I'm thinking specifically about human waste, okay, from a toilet. And then when you look at animal agriculture, it's a different thing. Slurry and Mostly soy, actually. That's the main output of standard farming practice at the moment. So the two different things, both very similar in many ways. It's both fecal waste from humans or from animals, or from cows at least. But they're the strength of those is quite different, and the pathogens that are present are slightly different, and the way that they're managed is typically very different as well. So that's one, just in terms of terminology on it. The other is that the solution to pollution, I think that, I mean, everybody watching this has been around the block, okay? So we know that we are in so much trouble. You know, that's not in question. And so I think that we're at the point where at the moment, as a culture, as a society, and as Western culture, everything we touch, we seem to just screw up. You know, in a rewilding sense, we're turned keystone species, and we're called desert making species because we do so much damage to our natural environment. Most other species manage to build the habitats that they want more of, and I'm very happy to talk at length about that. But basically, they managed to do that. Humans historically have turned paradise into a desert. You know, that's basically what we've done best. So I think that it's too late to do less harm. You know, we're at the brink of a monumental transformation for our whole society and for the whole world. And I think that if we delude ourselves by thinking that less harm is going to get us out of the mess we're in, then we're just plunging headlong into our own, you know, humanure. We really are, because that's just not going to work. So everything we touch needs to be actively regenerative. It needs to actively rebuild habitat. It needs to be actively good for biodiversity. All of those things that we need to do. Every single thing that we go at. And agriculture is one of those areas where we can be absolutely transformative remarkably easily. And so when you see the cows in the field, you're not when okay, so when a cow does a poop in the middle of a grass field and then moves on rapidly to the next field, et cetera, so the parasites aren't an issue. That's another whole way of looking at it. But basically, when a cow does a poop and pee on grass, it's not that you're diluting a waste. What you're doing is you're actively building the soil. You're actively building the nitrogen and the phosphorus in the soil. You're feeding the soil microorganisms, the soil fungi, and the soil bacteria. You're getting those interactions going between the mycorrhizae and the roots of the plants. You're building soil carbon. And wherever you're building soil carbon, you're building soil life. So the soil is one of those areas where we've just both desecrated and decimated the soils underneath our feet. And so at a time when we need to be actively rebuilding soil microbiology and microbiology on every different level, whether it's in the field or whether it's in our gut, we need to be rebuilding the microbiome, and because that's the basis of everything else.
Yes.
And
Okay. So,
so
well,
what
let
you're
me just
seeing,
let me
okay,
clear
do.
let make a clarifying point. This is great. This is great. This is that point of clarification is really good. And for your information, a lot of the we've had a lot of people on this podcast who have done who are doing regenerative agriculture. So that's something that's really well known to our listeners. So how does that set of principles compare to human waste? So let's talk about like the ecological functioning, because actually I only know, I only have scratched the surface on this topic. So I'd be curious to hear your take on that.
So let me see. So in a CAFO, you concentrate your population and you catch all the poop. And then you try and figure out what to do with the waste. Okay. In a standard urban center, you concentrate your population of people, you gather all your poop, and then you try and figure out what to do
Yeah,
with it.
right. This one,
Okay.
the
So that's
parallel I
the
was drawing.
similarity there. In regenerative agriculture, you're using your livestock and the ways that the livestock interact with the soil. So the particular grazing pattern, the timings, the footfall, the concentration of animals, all of those things. So that's what you could call the methodology with the poop and the pee, if you like. And so you're actively building soil. It's a more distributed system, but your aim is not to do less harm. It's to actively build your soil and your soil biology. Similarly, if, for example, we were to use the human population to gather carbon and nutrients in the form of humanure in compost toilets, and then incorporate that into the soil in our community gardens and our community orchards and nut plantations, forest, whatever it was, you know, to actively rebuild the soil, then what we begin to do is sequester and store carbon on a massive scale for a start. We begin to rebuild local sustainable food production and all of those things. I mean, I can, as you can see, I can go on and on and on and on and on. But, you know, just to summarize it very briefly, we could flip it around, because at the moment, both the CAFO and cities use a liquid infrastructure for waste management, whereas as soon as you begin to use a solid waste infrastructure like composting, all of a sudden, all of the good things begin to come about that instead of all of the bad things.
I, you know what comes to mind, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think part of it is both with, for example, animal agriculture and with the way we treat human waste, there's just this kind of like industrial mindset. This, and by that I mean thinking about these animals as and humans too, as, or what's coming out of them as just like sort of chemicals to deal with on like an industrial level, as opposed to thinking about humans, for example, as biological animals. We're getting nutrients from somewhere. From farms, we're putting it through our bodies, and then some nutrients are coming out of our bodies, and it's kind of a waste ecologically. Just thinking about like this cycle of nutrients. There's a concept in environmental sociology. You know, this is kind of talked about by like Marx and Weber as early as the beginning of the industrial society. But this idea of like linear nutrient cycles, where you're pulling from one part of an ecosystem, nutrients from farms, you're sending it to a city, and then the nutrients then get concentrated in the form of waste in a city. They're not going back into the place where where the ecology they came from. Whereas what we really need to be thinking about are ways to make nutrients cyclical. Is that accurate?
Oh yeah, basically yes. I mean, yeah. I mean, our current model, you're absolutely right. It's the take, use, dump model. Do you know? And where we're actually, what you see is that we're strip mining soils.
Right.
Do you know the numbers are being bandied around? We've 35 harvests left, 70 harvests left, whatever it is.
Yep.
You know, the numbers are kind of meaningless actually, because you can farm on very little for a start, very little soil. But the fact that there are numbers being used to begin to describe how many seasons we might have left in our capacity to feed ourselves is really insane. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just absolute madness to be continuing along the things that we're doing at the moment, continuing with the same methodologies, knowing that those methodologies are so destructive that we're strip mining soils out of the fields to the point where we won't be able to sustain ourselves
with
food.
That's one of my major concerns.
It's that process.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's just that process. It's that cyclical process. And what we've got, like, we're one of the most prolific land mammals, one of, you know, and basically we basically shit in the sea or in our drinking water.
Yeah.
You know, and that can't work.
Yeah.
It's just not, it's not a runner. And
no.
So getting all of those nutrients and all of that carbon back on the land again is crucial.
Yep. Real quick, before we move on from the doom, because I want to make sure we paint the correct and accurate picture to then move forward into the optimism. Is there anything else where you feel like we're sort of reaching ecological limits that really need to be, you know, highlighted, but besides the soil, besides the concentration of nutrients? Oh, did I go away for a second? Am I back?
You went away for a moment.
Okay.
Is there any way that we're reaching something?
Ecological limits, other ecological limits.
Ecological limits.
Yeah.
Can I tell you briefly what happens? So I don't know if I'll be asking your question, but I'll try. When sewage gets into fresh waters, then what happens then? So basically, all around Ireland and the US and most places where you've got a flush toilet, what you have is a situation where that water is treated to a greater or lesser degree before it goes into rivers and streams. And so what I see a lot, or what I've seen a lot in my work over the last 25 odd years, is the problems with that. And what you see is that basically your water quality begins to deteriorate quite rapidly when you've got sewage going in. So you've got elevated nitrates, elevated phosphates. They both lead to what's called eutrophication, which is excessive plant growth, excessive microbial algae growth, that type of thing. And that reduces the habitat value for fish and insects and the like. You also have what's called BOD, the biochemical oxygen demand. And that's basically, it's a chemical parameter, but it's a measure of the amount of food value in the water for microbes. So the higher the food value, the more the microbes will feed. The more the microbes feed, the more your dissolved oxygen level falls. Now, if your food value is too high, your oxygen levels can dip to the point where the fish and the insects can drown. And so when you see fish gills, that's when you get very, very high BOD levels entering water, and the oxygen is literally sucked out of the water by the microbes feeding on that food value. And so what you're seeing there is the fish gills as a result. And that's one of the relatively common causes. In Ireland, what we've seen, I know more about the numbers here, but what we've seen here over the last 30 years is we've seen a steady decline in the amount of serious pollution around the country. But we've also seen a drop in the number of what's called high status water bodies around the country. So they've nearly halved over the same time period. And so we get this accumulation in the middle ground of kind of mediocrity. Sounds a bit like politics, doesn't it? You know, the extremes are gone. But so the very bad is much less, but the very good is also shrinking. And what that basically means, some of our very highest water quality around Ireland has dropped. It's dipped below the 1% mark in the last 10 years, on and off. It hovers around the 1% mark, which means that for the insects that need pristine water to survive, for the what's called macroinvertebrates, they're macro, they're big enough to see with the naked eye, invertebrates meaning they don't have a backbone. So for those species, basically what you've done is you've bulldozed 99% of their habitat, of their houses, essentially, and said, okay, and there's no rebuilding plan. There's no rebuilding program planned at all. So you've lost your homes, pack your bags, and I don't know what. I mean, there's nowhere else to go. So they're kind of stuck. And so what we're seeing is a reduction in the species, the suite of species that occupy these really pristine habitats. And that's the way all over the world. We're seeing extinction rates at absolutely terrifying records, and they are terrifying levels. And from a Dunmore point of view, and I'm really happy to move on from this quite perspective on all of that. In this web of life, inevitably. And so every species plays its part holding hands within that web. And when you take away individual species, at some point, the Homo sapiens sapien, for some bizarre reason called wise twice, for some reason, we'll just fall through that net, And we won't, certainly in this culture, won't necessarily survive if we keep going with the ecological destruction that we've got at the moment. You know, there's cultures that will, there's cultures that have survived for millennia with zero impact essentially on the landscape, or very, very limited impact, and they'll probably survive as well. But our culture is hugely dependent on, on almost everything else in the world, on one another and on supply chains and on the natural world for everything that comes into our kitchen, to a phenomenal degree. And the pursuit of individualism and individuality and all of that lark, you too can be as individual as me if you wear the right logo, the pursuit of that has us just tied in so inextricably into an incredible mesh of different networks. But if we don't have the other species there that support the basis of that system, we'll just fall through. And we don't have the skills to survive outside that.
Yes. Okay, great. So we've laid out the doom. Now let's talk optimism. We can start wherever you feel is necessary to start and describing what the alternative is. What are some alternative systems to this?
Okay, so very briefly, it's actually really, really easy to build systems that work. And one of the things that I've tried to do over the last number of years is to 30 years, 20, whatever the number is. So throw concrete and steel at the whole project, and you can use loads of electricity and pump air through it to feed the oxygen into the water that provides the oxygen for the microbes, then feed on the BOD waste and get that lower and all that kind of stuff. So if you've got infinite amounts of energy and concrete and steel, then you're fine. And you can basically make all of the lovely nutrients that you've turned into a toxic loop less harmful for the environment in a fairly effective way. But if you don't want to use a lot of electricity, then if you build a reed bed system or a constructed wetland, that can do all of the same work for you, essentially for free, energy-wise. So you're digging out a large marsh, essentially, in your standard constructed wetland. It's 6 inches deep, not very deep, planted with a load of wetland plant species, so cattail and common reed, yellow flag iris, a whole suite of them that are really hungry. They spread really well. They mop up the nutrients, the nitrates and phosphates. They'll draw oxygen down through the stems into the roots, because they evolved over millennia to grow in saturated environments. And to get the air around the roots, they just pull it down through the leaves, which grass doesn't do. That needs to breathe at the root zone. And so that air becomes available at the root zone for microbes, which can treat the waste as well at the same time. You're basically building a creche for microbes, essentially. Whether it's a reed bed or whether it's a standard system, it's all the same job. You're basically building a creche for microbes, and they're going to be the ones that do all the work. Like in your gut, you're not eating to feed you, you're eating to feed your microbiome, and your microbiome then very generously provides you with exactly what you need. And it's the same in the soil or in a sewage treatment system. We're really reliant on these microbes to do a lot of the work for us.
Okay,
And
so
so,
oh yeah, please go continue.
yeah, so that's a really easy way to build a so standard soil-based constructed wetland, which is the common reed bed approach in the US. And then there's gravel reed bed systems, which are maybe 2 foot deep, filled with clean stone, and then they've got plants planted into them and the water passes through. It's another methodology. And then you've got some systems that are pump fed, where the liquid soaks down through your gravel media and then out the basin on.
Okay, so as happens on this podcast more often than we would like, there were some technical difficulties, my internet reset, but we are back and talking a little bit about the different alternative, these constructive wetland systems and different approaches to sewage treatment. So I'll let you continue and then we'll continue the conversation. So thanks for your patience. Sorry about that.
Thanks, Ashley. So you've got the soil-based constructed wetland, which is basically a marsh. That's the easiest one to build, particularly on heavy clay soil. And then the gravel reed bed is about 2 foot deep, roughly, with clean gravel, and then plants planted into that, and the water flows around the roots. And there's another version where you pump feed that, and the water trickles down through the gravel. You can do a gravelly version if you've got the gradient as well. And so those are the main constructed wetland and reed bed options. Now, bear in mind that these are actually still end of pipe technologies. So they're designed to make less harmful something that is harmful rather than recouping the nutrients. So the next stage would be to look and see, can we recoup some of the useful stuff from this? And a really easy way to do that is with willows. So in Scandinavia, in Denmark in particular, they've developed willow systems where you plant your willows, your Salix species, over your percolation area, but the piping is modified specially so that it doesn't block. And they mop up the nitrates and the phosphates. They love the amount of food in the water, and they love the amount of water as well. So they really like moist, nutrient-rich conditions. And so what you get there is a lot of willow production. And that willow biomass then is a source of, it's rich in carbon, it's rich in nitrates, rich in phosphates. It can be chipped, composted, used as a fuel. There's lots of ways that you can recoup that, use it for firewood, whatever it is, or even just a wildlife pile. So that's another way to recoup your nutrients. Another is to use comfrey over a percolation area. Comfrey is rich in nutrients. You can side that very easily and put that on a compost heap. So that's another way. So those are ways that you can plant again after your constructed wetland or reed bed or your septic tank, even. Those are all ways to achieve that. What I think is better, again, if we can do it and shift society in that direction gradually, is to use compost toilets and
Yeah, I was
urine
just going to ask
diversion
you.
and
Yeah, what are your
source
thoughts on
separation technologies. Okay.
that?
Yeah, source separation technologies like the Swedish Aquatron unit. So there's quite a number of different systems that are on the market or available for DIY building. Like, for example, solviva.com in Massachusetts. Anna Ide looks at what she calls a brown filter design, where you're filtering the grey water, the brown water pipe, from your toilet, black water, through a wood chip filter, and then using worms to compost the material in a box. It's a very straightforward system. It's one that we've got here actually at our new house, before a reed bed and wetland and a willow filter and all that. But basically, it's a good first end system instead of a septic tank, and all of those actively recoup the carbon and the nitrates and the phosphates, so they're actively regenerative rather than just doing less harm. So I think there's a lot of scope for a lot of rollout of that type of technology in the coming years.
Cool. So, okay, yeah, I have a compost toilet in our place right now, and it's a separate, it's a Swedish design, separates the urine and the waste feces, and the feces just go into a bucket, and we have a biodegradable bag, and we have a little humanure compost pile that we leave out for, it's got to be a couple years to make sure that it's really, really composted well and killed all the, any kind of nasty pathogens that could be in human manure. And then the urine tank urine separates out into like a kind of a leach area that's got some plants around it. And then separately in the house, all the other water sources, from the sinks, the shower, washing machine, all go into a gray water that has like a papyrus type plant that sort of soaks all that up, which is really cool. And it's pretty easy. We do live in a rural area with pretty low like regulations on that kind of thing. So we've been able to that is one thing. The regulations really do can potentially limit your freedom depending on where you live. But before we go deeper into some of like the technical aspects, I'm wondering, I don't know the answer to this question at all. Is there any historical precedent? I mean, pre-modern precedent to these kinds of systems, because it seems like everything I've read is kind of like a modern, almost scientific thought of how the microbes work and like the most advanced or up-to-date understanding about how to nutrient cycle. But is there any like historical precedent for any of these systems?
You in for compost toilet type systems or
Any
rainwater or
of
any
these.
of that?
Yeah.
Well, just I know that looking at constructed wetlands early on in my career, I remember hearing that the marshlands at the lower end of the Thames in London would have been de facto, water
Yeah.
filter wetlands.
Yeah, because
And
the
wetlands
water
naturally
kind of
filter
went in
water.
that direction from the city. Is that right?
Well, water, yes, exactly. Yeah, it would have night soil would have been collected, presumably, and a lot of the urine and everything else would have just drained down towards the Thames
Mm.
and been carried down along to the lower marsh areas within the Thames. And then the wetlands have evolved naturally over millennia to grow in saturated, nutrient-rich environments anyway. It's where
Right.
they've thrived. And so
Right.
they would have loved that abundance of nutrients and done a really good job of filtering the water and keeping the water clean. And of course, as you get more and more city development, your wetlands get squeezed out.
Yep.
And then suddenly you end up with the twin problems of, too many people and too much pollution and disease and all that kind of stuff.
And not enough
So
ecology to sort of
exactly
take
to
up the,
sustain it.
right,
Exactly.
yeah. And
That's it.
actually one thing I want to mention now that you said that, I took a class in college about Hurricane Katrina and learned a little bit about the ecology around New Orleans, and was learning that the wetlands kept, sort of getting paved over little by little around New Orleans, to the point that if the wetlands were still there, they can actually limit the flooding, limit the impact of storms, and they have multiple positive functions. But the impulse is just to sort of over-engineer everything and make locks and make levees and this kind of thing, as opposed to thinking about ways in which we can manage human settlement with ecologies. But briefly, if you have a point on that, but I want to ask you about night soils too, because that's something I don't think a lot of people know about.
There's two brief things that I want to look at there. One is that the Thames is one example that I don't know a lot about, but that's just what I had heard at the time. The other is that my understanding is that the city of Paris was the last city in Europe, apparently, to adopt the flush toilet as a technology. And so up until the late 1800s, apparently Paris was exporting lettuces into the surrounding country, because there was so much compost toilet material that they had amazing soil and grew amazing vegetables. And so the city was a net exporter of vegetables rather than a net importer of vegetables, of the high value vegetables. And so that's that, it's the flow. Does the flow just move towards the thing that we're trying to kill, or does it move towards the thing that we're trying to nurture and support? And so that's one element just on that subject. Just briefly looking at flooding in a more general context, one of the issues obviously with wetlands is that if you've got floodplains and wetlands at the lower reaches of a river, when the river floods, it can spill into those areas and spread out quite safely and settle there. So in Curitiba, for example, in Brazil, one of the things that was done there, I think the late 80s or the early 90s, is that they basically removed people from the slum areas and gave them better housing on areas that were slightly higher ground, because the slums used to flood. It was on the worst, poorest, lowest ground. And they returned those areas to parkland. So when there was floods, the park just flooded, and it just wasn't an issue at all. And meantime, you've got lovely amenity areas as well for the people in the city to enjoy. And so by putting back in areas that can flood, that's a hugely valuable thing to do. The other side of all of that is that flooding isn't necessarily a carbon climate change issue as much as a land use climate change issue. That if you change the whole of the Mississippi Valley, if you take artificial fertilizer that's been manufactured using the Haber-Bosch method, which evolved out of World War II, and you spread that on your soil, the nitrogen pellets will come in contact with the soil carbon, with the glomalin glue that holds the soil structure together, and release that carbon into the air. So you destroy your humus layer within the soil. Once you destroy the humus layer, when the rain falls, there's nothing to hold it together. There's no crumb structure. So the rain, you're nodding as if you know all of this already, and I can
Yeah, no,
understand
but I'm glad you're
having
saying it.
all
Say
the
it again. It's
regenerative stuff on the website
No, it's
completely.
good.
So, and it just washes through and goes straight into the rivers and streams. Now, given that humus can hold up to 20 times its own weight in water, if you strip out the humus year on year using artificial nitrogen, then what's happening is you're completely eliminating or certainly reducing the capacity of the whole agricultural catchment to hold on to that water when it falls. And if you do that, how can you not have flooding downstream, without ever even looking at carbon balances that are involved? And the beauty of it is, of course, that anything you do that supports nature also builds carbon and stores carbon. Whereas anything, anyway, it's one of the as you look at the doomer optimism thing, I mean, we have an example where in the Amazon basin, for example, the Amazon interior is drying up. Again, you look at that, you point the finger at climate change and carbon. And really, when it comes to dealing with carbon, there's two ways of looking at it. One is it's really, really easy. All you need to do is get 10 of the major companies to turn off their tap on oil and gas, and your problem is sorted. But we're obviously not doing that. And so your next step is to come up with a natty slogan that'll get onto the 9 o'clock news. And that's not a terribly empowered position to be in when it comes to taking on some of the biggest companies in the world and trying to work sanely with the world. But the more I look at water in the landscape, the more I see the connections between the symptoms of climate change and water management, which are completely independent of carbon. So, and I don't know enough about the carbon side of things to comment too much that way, but I do know directly that if you muck with the land, you're going to get flooding. You're going to get droughts, which is the flip side. I mean, droughts don't bother people as much in the Irish context, for example, when rivers and streams dry up. But if you go and interview the fish, they're pissed off. They really don't like it. And so that flood drought cycle is hugely important from a biodiversity point of view. And if you look at California, the lowering groundwater levels, the wildfires, that all of that kind of stuff, that if you drain every city in the area, and if you drain a lot of your agricultural land to get that water into the sea as quickly as possible, two things are going to happen. Your groundwater is going to fall, and your sea levels are going to rise if you do that on a global basis. There were storms between 2010 and 2011. There were heavy storms, apparently in Australia, Southeast Asia, and South America. And during that time of heavy rainfall, apparently the global sea levels dropped by 1 full centimeter. That's 1 full centimeter in a single season of heavy rainfall. Now, if you can keep that rain on the land and store that in wetlands, in marshes, in forests, in woodlands, in hedgerows, in wet, boggy corners of fields, in soil carbon itself, in the compost, all of those things, you get to hold on to that soil on the land. Sorry, to hold on to that water on the land. And your flooding and your droughts stop, your groundwater begins to replenish and dry out, your sea levels begin to stabilize or fall. All of those good things happen. And I was talking about the Amazon, I'm jumping around a little bit. The Amazon basin is drying out at the moment. Now, you've heard of the biotic pump, where trees take up water from the soil and they evaporate the water into the air through the leaves. They also evaporate and they also release bacteria that act as condensation nuclei. So, do you remember I was saying that Homo sapiens, we seem to be desert-making species? Trees want lots of rainfall. So they will actively mold their environment to produce lots of rainfall. So they release the water vapor. They also release the condensation nuclei. And recent research coming out of Russia over the last, recently in the last 10, 13 years, seems to suggest that trees can also actually create wind. So they can pull in the air from the oceans quite specifically and pull that wind across the forest itself, so that the area of heavy rainfall gets bigger and bigger and bigger, so that the area of forest cover can get bigger and bigger and bigger. So basically what happens then when you take the 100 to 300 kilometers close to the coast on the interface between the Amazon and the Atlantic, and you bulldoze that and you turn it into soya farms to grow soya meal to send to Ireland or anywhere else to feed cows. Here in Ireland, we have amongst the best grass in the world anyway. Here in New Zealand, you have really quick growing grass. And it's what makes those 40 shades of green, And so if you import soy meal instead, what you're doing is you're clearing the forests. Once you clear the forests, what have you done? You've broken your pump. No amount of haggling over carbon budgets is going to fix that pump. But the beauty of it is that all you need to do to fix the pump is to pay Brazilian farmers a fraction more to plant trees and mine them than to grow soy meal. And so it's a win-win-win for everybody, except of course the agrochemical industry. And I'm okay with
You're totally preaching to the choir here. I've been
can
studying
imagine.
this. Yeah, I've been studying this stuff in quite a lot of detail, and I just have really come to the conclusion that a much more empowered perspective is to think about these more sort of scaled down ecologically or bioregionally specific solutions that are maybe mitigation st strategies or adaptation strategies, but they could kind of be both, and they can
Absolutely.
also be carbon sinks in many cases in ways we don't even really quite understand yet.
Beautiful.
And I think that scaling those solutions up is just really the, I think a lot of people have sort of evolved to that position that the scale of solution, thinking about how water moves, how soil works, what role, functioning ecosystems play, like what role trees actually pull in water from the air and concentrate it. It like almost feels spiritual or mystical or something. But once you start learning the science, it's almost, a little bit religious, like, wow, look at how amazing this ecosystem functions. And thinking about our potential role as stewards of that. At one point I want to go back to is, I think a lot of people tend to not think of cities as potential sites of ecological restoration, but what you said about Paris is really interesting to me. And I'm wondering whether we can just kind of riff on thinking about like cities as nutrient concentration sites, as in human animals being
Completely.
nutrient, concentrating there. And maybe you could just talk briefly about what night soils are, because that kind of illustrates the point. And maybe like what a modern version of recouping those nutrients look like.
Okay. So night soil is the poop collected in a usually a basin in a seat with a hole in it, historically, and then I think thrown out the top window at some point and collected by the poor unfortunate street cleaners down below. And it's still used in some parts of the world. That's still gathered and composted and used for growing plants. And a more, I suppose, friendly way to deal with night soil is to collect it ourselves and compost it ourselves rather than relying on somebody else to do it. It's not a terribly pleasant job to outsource. But we tend to outsource things. It's what we tend to do. We hide behind so many layers of outsourcing that I could say you wouldn't believe it, but of course you would. So let me see. So night soils, yeah, I think that cities could potentially be incredible hubs of ecological recovery and biodiversity. I think the potential is absolutely enormous. And one of the things, of course, to remember is that what the city is doing is it's pulling in, as you say, lots of nutrients, lots of biomass, lots of carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, all of those things. It's also pulling in ideas, and it's pulling in money, it's pulling in energy. So cities have this magnetic quality to them. I personally, I can't be in one for very long, But you know, but they are these incredible hubs of energy and vitality. And I think that by looking at how do we support the commons within cities, we've had many, many decades of stripping the commons out, not just out of cities actually, but out of many areas. I mean, malls in the States are one of the examples where you're basically taking what could be the street corner, which is a public space, and enclosing it in private ownership, you know. And then you're basically saying you need a car to get from anywhere to anywhere, which involves more layers of private ownership and more layers of wealth and all of that thing. And by reintroducing commons areas within cities, whether it's as community gardens, community orchards, community woodlands, community ponds, whatever it is, just those spaces for, I mean, the resurgence in farmers markets is a wonderful development in, you know, in recent decades.
Yeah, and
And
might I, sorry, might I
sure.
add? So this place I went to visit that I mentioned at the beginning, outside of Portland, a small municipality, like a suburb of Portland, basically. And the guy running it was really outside of the box. You know, obviously
Okay.
had come across these constructed wetlands, and it was a municipal water treatment plant. I've reached out to them; they haven't gotten back to me to come on the pod, but I'll just explain what I saw. Basically, it's, you know, an industrial treatment plant, but this guy, the one running it, you know, really wanted to think outside the box and think, is there some other way of doing this? So he did this constructed wetland as like an experiment to see if it would work in their area. So to sort of pump the sewage into that wetland, and when he came in, he brought in this Japanese landscape architect who planted a bunch of trees around the wetland in like a sideways manner. And the point he was trying to make was just to like observe what they did, and they kind of grew out and then back up. And it was like the point was that nature will recover itself; it has its like natural ways to recover itself.
That's
Anyways.
very cool.
Yeah, the wetland, and then he experimented with all sorts of like different mushrooms, and he brought this mushroom expert Paul Stamets down to advise, and all these different kinds of mushrooms that could potentially pull different toxins out. You know, there's issues with different kinds of toxins, pharmaceuticals, this kind of stuff. So testing that, and you know, just different kinds of systems, and the wetland ended up becoming one of the top birding sites for the society in the United States called the Audubon Society, in the state of Oregon. So people would come and use it as a park, and then there's a, you know, a little area to walk around. And now this is kind of dovetailing with what you were talking to me about, the parks. Low-level parks in the city, as a place that can kind of handle flooding if it happens, that could have wetlands associated with it, could also be like a composting area for, you know, this kind of material in a city. And then it could basically, like, natural disasters don't, I mean, this was my paper in college about Hurricane Katrina. Natural disasters aren't natural, really. They're human, many of them are human-made. There's a lot of human-made elements to the way they play out.
Totally.
And so just thinking about that too, that, you know, thinking about really using ecological systems to our advantage to
Interesting.
ma
Very
manage.
cool. There's just in terms of applying the humidor on a city scale, there's a number of different technologies that you can use that would combine the two. So there's a Swedish unit called an aquatron separator, and then you flush your toilet. The pipe goes down to the separator unit, and the fecal material and the paper fall out one side, and the liquids go onto another side. And you can
Interesting.
also get urine diversion toilets. So, ladies and gents, alike, please sit down, and the urine goes out the front, and the fecal material goes out the back. So you have yellow water and brown water, as opposed to your black water. And then again, you recoup the nutrients in your yellow water and reuse that. And so, those are really easy ways from the point of view of the user of the toilet. They don't necessarily need to know that there's all that much going on. And yet you've got all this magic occurring at the back where those captured nutrients can be part of what feeds the soil in the local area. When I was calling constructed wetlands an end of pipe technology, and I just want to clarify a little bit that what you say there about the municipal system, the grey water from the city can be quite polluting. You know, all of the cleaning chemicals that everybody buys, you know, ideally, if you clean your surfaces with food, like vinegar and bread soda and, you know, and lemon juice, then it's going to be much safer for watering your plants with that than if you buy something with ingredients that you can't pronounce. You know, very, very straightforward. Or even if you buy your cleaners in a health food shop, it's much safer than buying it in a local supermarket. So let me see. So the constructive wetland can be really, really useful for making your grey water much, much cleaner and much less harmful. And as you say, utilizing that then as a birding area or wildlife habitat, a place for people to reconnect with nature.
Yep. And I'll just w mention one other thing I saw at that place because I love this. That was the best field trip ever. I was at a sociology conference. He also told this story about okay, so when water comes into a water treatment plant, it's usually like above room temperature because there's so much heated water from showers and washing machines, et cetera. And so before they can, after they treat it and before they can release it back into the watershed, they have to cool the water down. And typically the way to do that is through a refrigeration system, which was like, X number of million dollars. And he had a hypothesis that if along the sort of riparian waterways from the waste treatment facility to the local river, they sort of planted reed beds, wetlands, and trees. He had a hypothesis that the water would cool down enough by kind of constructing these like little corridors for the water to go through, and he was right. And so they did this system, and then it was like more
Brilliant.
parkland, more beautiful, more functioning ecology. But it also solved the problem. And of course, he had to have the political will to pitch this to, the city council or whatever.
Course.
And they are, outside of Portland, obviously open to it. But it was like, okay, I need either $5 million to plant all of these things, or 10 million to buy this refrigeration system. Like it's a risk reward calculation,
Indeed.
but
That's right.
but then the ongoing cost of maintenance of the refrigeration system versus this other system, which kind of functions on its own once you've built it,
Completely.
was really cool. Okay, so one other thing I wanted to ask you about, since you're steeped in it, and I've only been on the periphery of this world, tell me a little bit about the history, modern history of, the constructed wetlands movement. I don't know much about the actors. You said that there was people from Australia and the US who came to this conference. So like, tell me the hubs, tell me who are the actors involved. What's the state of the movement? Is it catching on at all?
It's certainly becoming more popular. It's in more of the regulatory codes around the world, so that's very much in place more and more. Now, let me see. I don't know how much more history I know than what I was saying. Basically, in the early 1990s, that was when systems started to go into Ireland. They'd been used by the Tennessee Valley Authority up to that point as well. That they'd been used in the US before that. So Dr. Donald Hammer from the Tennessee Valley Authority, he was the person who came over to talk about constructed wetlands at that conference. I know that there were systems in Austria rather than Australia,
Oh,
in
sorry.
Austria for gravel reed bed systems.
Okay.
And so that was for, municipal sewage, domestic one-off houses, that type of thing, running the liquid through gravel beds. And of course, you see in the technologies straight away, land is plentiful in the US. You've got these big, extensive soil-based wetlands. The land is more limited in the middle of Europe, where you have these smaller gravel reed bed systems. It's just interesting to see that at the outset. But when they started to be built, I don't really know. There was a system in Ireland. We have a relatively small military, let's put it that way. And but in our there was an army system put in the 1800s in a place called the Curragh Camp. So the Curragh Camp would be the main training grounds for military in Ireland, in Kildare, in the east part of the country. And there was a constructed wetland system there, or some sort of a type of constructed wetland system put in, I believe, in the late 1800s. By who exactly? I mean, the British Army, presumably at the time. I think it might have been a German technology at that time. So that's kind of one thread that I'd pull on if I was to try and investigate that a little bit further.
And
In terms of.
how is it the state of, at least in Ireland now, are you seeing some interest, some uptake, at the municipal level, at the consumer household level? Like what's the state of, interest in it over the course of your career,
Yeah, very much so. It has increased. I mean, when I started in 1996, one of the ideas was to raise awareness around the whole idea. And so by 1999, the first Irish codes were written that included constructive wetlands in their brief. 1999, 2000, there were codes. Then in 2010, they were updated. There were new codes broadening the number of different reed bed types. And then most recently in 2021, again, we've started to look at willows as well as part of that overall suite. And while I might disagree with some of the decisions made in the drafting of the documentation, I'd just love to see more natural systems in there and more support for natural systems. But it's a process. But what I'm seeing is that they're there, they're very firmly within the codes. And globally as well, they're also included more in global codes. And what I find quite exciting is that increasingly the codes are beginning to use the dry toilet technologies, source separation technologies. The EPA in Victoria and Australia, they're looking at that th they've got different streams. So the black water and the grey water. So the black is from the toilet, for anybody else who doesn't know. The grey water is from everything else within the house. Stormwater is the water that comes off the roof from the driveway, that kind of stuff. And the stormwater should go separate from the rest of it. The black and the grey usually goes down to your septic system. So in the Australian codes, when you've got a urine diverting toilet, they reclassify the urine line as yellow water and the other flush water as brown water. And what that differentiation means is that you make different decisions about what happens to what waste. Do you know what I mean? How do you recoup it? How do you get the maximum use? How do you get the benefits out of it? Like the permaculture principles, getting multiple uses from any element. And so what I find encouraging is to see that acknowledgement within the regulatory codes at a global level just beginning to come in, which is quite exciting, just in the last 10 years, really.
Yeah, and I mean, just last week, there was a huge amount of flooding in New York City and New Jersey. And in my opinion, just if you're thinking on a strategic level, if you say something like, oh, this is the fault of climate change, sure, but what could we do right now to take that water and see where it moves and move it in ways that can be beneficial, don't cause as much damage. I mean, I know somebody personally whose basement flooded and $100,000 worth of damage. Think about the ecological outcomes of ripping out all of this drywall and all of this stuff and throwing it all away, and then re-putting all of this new material in to reconstruct a home. I think this is just totally underestimated the amount of waste that happens
Actually,
with.
it's good for the economy.
Yeah, I know. So I just think, think
No,
about ways
it's
in which you
insane.
can
It
handle
is
these
insane.
movement of water in a way that works with ecologies. There's so many technologies out there. More and more municipalities are taking up great stormwater gardens, permeable pavers, advancing their systems to work with nature instead of against it. Okay, so if you have a statement to implore listeners, what are we shooting for? What are we calling for here in this episode?
Okay, you've got me on the statement to implore listeners. It's a much longer answer than that. So I'm going to jump in and give it to you anyway. One of the things that I've been really excited to do over the last number of years, since COVID really, is to step away from the sewage design work. I'm seeing that the codes are there. The information is in the codes. If you want to do it, read the code and just do it. It's not difficult. Just go ahead and do it. So, okay, now it's beginning to make money. So I'm no longer interested in it. Do you know what I mean? What's the next thing that's daft? And so what I was turning my attention to at the beginning of COVID, when there was time to do stuff without worrying about an economic return, because nobody was making any money. So you could do what you wanted to do rather than try to make money. And so what I turned my attention to was that the twin elements of rewilding and landscape repair. And so looking at that very much through the lens of water. So what I was looking at was what are the natural dynamics in the landscape, in the rewilding context, and how do they impact on water and water quality, and how do we maximize those in order to deal with all of the things that we've been talking about, quality, flooding, droughts, all of that, soil building. So basically, if you in the context of a municipality, how do you think like a beaver? it's a really obvious question when it comes to water storage. So
Right.
you've got your sludge units in the urban context, your sustained urban drainage systems, where you're holding onto water in swales, in bioretention areas, rain gardens, stormwater wetlands, all of those things. In the agricultural catchment, it's the same thing. You know, if you're thinking like a beaver in the agricultural catchment, you're slowing down the farm drains that are leaving the farm in poorly soaking areas. Ireland is a very wet country, and a lot of our soil is very, very heavy and impermeable. So we've got lots of drains on our farms, just open surface drains. And I've been working with a lot of farming groups in the last 5 years, and we've really been taking a deep dive into this whole process of how do we look at slowing down the flow, filtering the water, and being the beaver on the farms. And that's it, because we don't have beavers in the Irish context.
Right. So
So,
you
I'm
are.
it.
Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
that's it. And so that's one way to look at that side. And of course, it's not just the beaver. You know, you've got your bison, your buffalo in the European context or the North American context. And what the buffalo will do is open up areas, you know, keep the landscape open for pastures and for meadow wildflowers and all that kind of stuff. It'll build up soil carbon and keep the ground clear and open. And then the flip side, so that's really useful to build that soil carbon in that context. And then if you've got too much of that, then you need to bring in your wolf to act as the police
Predator,
of the river, you know,
right.
to keep them away from the rivers. So in the Irish context, where we don't have bison, but we have many, many cows,
Yep.
and we don't have wolves, but we do have many farmers. Do you know, we
Yeah.
begin to rebuild those dynamics that build the soil and help to bring back as many of those missing elements as possible for the purposes, apart from the sheer fun of it all, for the purposes of actually, you know, rebuilding the capacity of the landscape to manage its own water and to regulate all of the, you know, the dynamics that are there.
I love it. I love that so much. Yeah, that is the wheelhouse that we've been talking about in the mostly in the American context on this podcast. But I would love to hear from some Irish farmers who are implementing it and talk about the ecosystem dynamics there and you know what's the natively occurring wildlife, what you know ecological niches are you trying to fill, and how are you thinking about it? It would be so cool. One thing as we have as a the way we run this podcast is anyone who's been a guest can then, you know, tag and bring come and become a host and, you know, tag team with the host they had and sort of bring the next person on if they have somebody they think needs to or deserves a platform to talk about what they're
Very
doing. So
good.
you're
Brilliant.
welcome to bring somebody on if you'd like.
Thank
Okay,
you very much.
so
Sounds exciting.
anything that I haven't touched on that you for sure want to just sort of get on the record while we're recording before we go.
There are. There's two things. One is that at the moment, as we look at the world, I'm running the risk of dipping into Doomer for a sec, okay?
That's fine, it's fine.
You know, we know that we're in trouble. Okay, so when I'm teaching courses, I teach a number of courses in different groups and areas. And when I'm teaching courses, I ask people, okay, raise your hands. Who thinks we're screwed? You know, who thinks we're really gone too far? And, you know, about 30, 40% of the hands go up. And the others, God love them, you know, they just don't know yet. You know, so that's the kind of way. But so there's a concern there. But one of the things that I want to point out, and I'm not dismissing the climate science and all of that kind of stuff, but I do want to point out that from a kind of a Newtonian physics perspective, then if you're, what am I trying to say? The best available science doesn't take into account the many mysteries that exist in the world.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the temperature gradient between June and December in the Northern Hemisphere, you've got a sharp drop in temperature. Okay? So if you take that block of data and you say, okay, let's extrapolate. In 6 months' time, we're all going to freeze to death. Okay? That's
Yeah.
taking the best available science that's in front of us. And I'm not dismissing the capacity of the scientists to come up with really good ideas, really good data. But if you don't acknowledge some of the stuff that exists and that we know about, you know, the framework for miracles, if you don't acknowledge that, the world is a really depressing place because we're all looking at freezing to death next June,
Right.
you know, which obviously doesn't happen. And I'm not taking a Pollyannish view and saying it'll all be fine, there's no work to do. What I'm saying is there's hope. You know, There is so much to play for. There is so much work to do. And the opportunity is there to jump in and to do that. And that exists. And we can grasp that now and run with it. And so that's one thing, just looking at trajectories. And the other is, as we look at quantum physics as a source of our analogies, that also brings me a lot of hope. Because in Newtonian physics, whoever has the most force wins. That's the fundamental rule of Newtonian physics, essentially. With quantum physics, you can do something over here and miracles unfold over here. And who the,
Nobody
who
knows.
knows what's going on? There's quantum physicists who've said, I don't know what's going on. And anybody who does is obviously lying or doesn't understand it. No, we really don't know. We're like babies in this. We're really grappling with something very new, but really exciting. And there are direct connections between the micro and the macro in this. But also, as to bring that into our language and to begin to bring the learnings from quantum physics, this is not new. Like, this has been around for 100 years, at least. So the Newtonian physics has been dead and buried. It was a long funeral, but we need to get rid of this idea that he or she who has the most force wins the game, because ultimately the economic machine that's rolling along can very firmly claim the accolade of having the most force. And as you try to affect change in the world, if you keep your eye on that machine, it's really depressing. But if you can take your eye off of that and back onto what you can do, what's right in front of you now? What can you do now? What miracles can you nurture? And not just in the world, not just in your garden, not just in your city or your little parcel of land, but what can you do in your mind? Because the human mind has this incredible capacity for dreaming. And what we dream tends to manifest. And by pulling that in again, without being dreamy about it, well, I am being dreamy about it, but basically, how do we nurture the miracle? Do you know, in conventional medicine, if you get a terminal illness, conventional medicine says, right, okay, you're done. You're snookered. But miracles happen all the time. If you don't like miracles, that's okay, that's fine. If that doesn't fit with your cosmology, I'm happy with spontaneous remission. I don't mind what you call it. I just want it to happen. And so by bringing that in, there's the capacity to begin to step into what Charles Eisenstein calls the more beautiful worlds that our hearts know as possible. And I think that we can just watch miracles coming into bloom all around us in so many ways.
That's so beautiful. That's such a great way to end. I mean, I would just completely echo that. What you're saying is totally resonant with everything that we've been trying to put out on the podcast. And I would also just say, I think one thing that people don't realize is once you really start in the process of ecological restoration, it is really quick, the returns. And I think sometimes we think about ecological issues as being so big and so overwhelming. We just think like we can't even begin to start with this. But if you've ever done it, I mean, if you've ever really, I mean, that wetland was constructed and I think it was over the course of like 5 years. And then all of a sudden it's like this Audubon site. Nature wants to recover. It's not
Totally.
actually even that complicated. And
That's
it
it.
doesn't even take that long. It just takes some intentionality and some care and some attention and some agency and some power,
That's
and
right.
some openness to miracle, I guess I would say.
And it's so exciting to watch it, to watch those changes. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it's
Yeah,
wonderful. So,
completely. Yeah, I echo that 100%.
yeah. Well, thank you so much. This was lovely. You're perfect. I'm so glad Scott Brian suggested you. You're a perfect match for the podcast. So, total fellow traveler. So, thank you so much.
Totally.
And I hope that you do end up coming back and bringing other guests on. That would be
Great.
wonderful.
It sounds amazing. It's
Okay.
been lovely to talk to you, Ashley. Thanks a million for reaching out. It's been a
Yeah.
great pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you
Bye-bye.
very, very much.